speak on the Srimad Bhagavatam, particular nice section from Srimad Bhagavatam, glorifying one of the Lord's pure devotees. When we think of Srimad Bhagavatam, from the first canto, seventh chapter, we know that, or sixth chapter, Narada was instructing Vyas to compose one literature that simply glorifies the Supreme Lord. If you want to... Okay, chaos that's going on. What's up? Some air, fresh air?
Let's just go up a slide.
Those are the latches right there in this one. Canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. We get a statement of the purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's a transcendental literature exclusively dedicated to glorification of the Lord, which means glorification of the Lord's devotees. Because we're going to find out as this chapter unfolds, or this section of the Bhagavatam unfolds, that the Lord likes very much to decorate his devotees. He likes to honor his devotees. He likes to praise his devotees. He likes to be in a position even subordinate to his devotees. So this is an opportunity to honor and glorify the reverberation is too much. Glorification of the process of pure devotional service and glorification of the pure devotee. The person, the pure devotee that we're going to speak about is Maharaj Ambarish. And the description of Maharaj Ambarish comes in the ninth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada has given a name for each of the cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam. The ninth canto is liberation. Tenth canto is summum bonum. Ninth canto liberation, it comes just before Krishna's appearance in the tenth canto. But this process of liberation is most successfully achieved by the rendering of pure devotional service. So the setting at the very beginning of the chapter, at the very beginning of the canto, rather, is description of the descendants of the seventh Manu, Vaivasvata Manu, because Lord Krishna appears during the reign of Vaivasvata Manu. The Swayam Bhagavan Krishna appears during the 28th millennium of the seventh Manu in each day of Brahma. So, going back into the Bhagavatam, the Swayambhuva Manu, the first of the 14 Manus, is described in the third canto. And then his first son, Priyavrata, he decides, I don't want any involvement in family life and worldly dealings, I'll turn the kingdom over to my younger brother, Uttanapada. And then from Uttanapada, Dhruva Maharaj. And the whole lineage of descendants of Swayambhuvamanu. And as we approach into the eighth canto, we're hearing of several of the Manus in rapid succession. But the ninth canto is Vairasvatamana. So to appreciate a person, to appreciate anything, that appreciation is enhanced by the setting or the context that we find that something or that find that person. So I want to describe a little bit preceding the life of Maharaj Ambarish by going back a couple of chapters before his appearance, and I'd like to describe one king who was one of the sons of Vaivasvatamanu, and there's an important reason for doing this also. There's an episode that takes place that has a lot of relevance to the Maharaj Ambarish story. One of Vaivasvatamanu's sons was King Shariyati, and he was a very exalted soul, and he had one son or one daughter, Sukanya. And as a pious king, he wanted to ensure that his daughter Sukanya would be would have a very auspicious life. So she wanted to, as the king with his daughter, seek the blessings of the sages. So he decided from his palace, not so far away, was Chavanamuni. So he and his royal assembly and his daughter and all of her friends went one time to visit Chavanamuni. And when they reached the hermitage of Chavanamuni, the others who were residing with him in that hermitage informed the king that he was not available. He was in meditation at the time, so they just had to wait. So they occupied themselves in various ways, the king and his entourage, and the daughter and her friends. And being a young lady, she and her friends went into the garden, and they were enjoying the wonderful garden that was there. And in the course of being in the garden, Sukanya saw in the ground two earth holes, and in the inside the earth holes there were two glowing like lights or substances or something. And so, like a young girl might do, she was curious and took a thorn and was probing in the hole, and all of a sudden some blood started coming out of the hole. She became very frightened and ran from the place. And just at that same time, the king and his attendants and everyone became simultaneously afflicted with constipation, and they were unable to pass urine, and as some time passed, became very uncomfortable. So they began discussing, and lo and behold, everyone had the same affliction. And lo and behold, it happened at the same time. So Sukanya happened to overhear their discussions, and she came forward in a very shy manner and explained to her father, "Perhaps I'm the cause of this problem." And she explained what happened. So the king was very, very concerned. And after some time, it turned out that the glowing substances, it was Chavanamuni. He was not just in meditation, he was in meditation underground. And one of his favorite meditation spots was in the garden. And the thorn poked his eyes. And so the king, Shariyati, was very, very afraid of the wrath of Chavanamuni. And so after some time passed, Chavanamuni came forward, and the king rushed before him, threw himself at his feet, offered many, many prayers, asking for forgiveness, explained the whole situation, and just gave him an open statement that whatever it is that you would like that would pacify you or compensate for this way that you have been disrespected and harmed, it's yours. You just say it, whatever it is. So Chavanamuni didn't say what it was, but some indirect indication was given that he was attracted to Shariyati's daughter. He was a great sage and a great mystic yogi, but he was a little lusty. And he was very, very old enough to be the grandfather of Sukanya, and invalid. But because the king had given his commitment, so very well, so it shall be. My daughter will marry you. And they were married. And as time passed, Sukanya came to understand something further about Chavanamuni, and basically he was a grumpy, grouchy guy. He was old, he was invalid, and he was grumpy. Really grumpy. And the way Prabhupada describes it is that it was because he was kind of like this male ego thing. He was very proud. He did not want anyone to be in a superior position to him. And as a result, anything that came along that appeared to be of challenge to his position made him grumpy. So that's a difficult situation to deal with. We all know people that are grouchy and grumpy and hard to get along with. So there's some very nice instructions here, which I'd like to just read right from Prabhupada's purport. It's nice instructions how to deal in this dynamic, and it's specifically its instructions in household life, instructions for the ladies in the household. Sukanya could understand the attitude of her husband, and under the circumstances, she treated him accordingly. If any wife wants to be happy with her husband, she must try to understand her husband's temperament and please him. This is victory for a woman. Now, pleasing a husband and being victorious over the husband, they're opposites. But in the mood of pleasing the husband, it enhances it is very soothing and satisfying for the husband, who then submits to the concerns and interests of the wife. And that in that way, it's victory. Victory meaning a very compatible situation. Even in dealings of Lord Krishna with his different queens, it has been seen that although the queens were daughters of great kings, they placed themselves before Lord Krishna as his maidservants. However great a woman may be, she must place herself before her husband in this way. That is to say, she must be ready to carry out her husband's orders and please him in all circumstances. Then her life will be successful. When the wife becomes as irritable as the husband, the given circumstances, the husband is irritable, the wife becomes as irritable as the husband, their life at home is sure to be disturbed and ultimately completely broken. In modern days, the wife is never submissive, and therefore home life is broken even by slight incidents. And then Prabhupada comments from the other perspective. Westerners contend that this is a slave mentality for the wife. But factually, it is not so. It is the tactic by which the woman can conquer the heart of her husband, however irritable or cruel he may be. Now, and on the side, we do draw some lines here where persons are just grossly abusive and so on and so on. That's a big problem. But at least in this particular case, Shravana Muni became very, very calm. His grumpy nature subsided. In fact, it turned around just the other way. We're going to find that out. And she had a very, very difficult situation. She's married to someone who's old enough to be her granddaughter. He can hardly move around. He's very, very infirm. And he's got this temperament that's just really touchy. But she was trained and had the quality of being very chaste. So it made that... She was very expert in understanding the mind of her husband, the temperament of her husband, acted accordingly, not in contrast, but acted accordingly. And things worked very, very nicely, as we'll see as the story goes on. So I wanted to highlight this particular point from something from Mahabharata. The scene in Mahabharata is where the queens of Dwaraka are together with the Pandavas and Draupadi. And as circumstance would have it, the queens were together with Draupadi and they were discussing various matters, and Satyabhama asked Draupadi a very relevant question, she was very interested to understand the answer to this question. She wanted to know, how is it that you are able to control the five most powerful people on this planet as your husbands? Then she said, is there some science to this? Do you have certain mantras that you use? Do you put some kind of herb in the food, and, you know, some kind of potion or some kind of black magic, or what is it that you do? Please tell. And Draupadi's response is, Satyabhama, how can you suggest such a thing? But this is abominable behavior. And if any man were to understand that his wife was doing these things, then it would be like knowing that a poisonous serpent has entered the house and there would be no rest. And she goes on with that idea. And then she presents her formula for success in her domestic duties. So I'd like to read what Draupadi says. O illustrious Satyabhama, hear now of my conduct toward the high-souled Pandavas. Abandoning vanity and subduing desire and wrath, I always serve with devotion the Pandavas with all their wives. To add to the whole formula, the Pandavas is not just five Pandavas and one Draupadi, it's five Pandavas and multiple wives. So she serves them all equally. Restraining jealousy and devotion of heart without any feelings of degradation at the service I perform, I always serve my husbands. ever fearing to utter what is evil and false, or to look or sit or walk with impropriety, or to cast glances indicative of the feelings of the heart, I serve the sons of Ptah, those mighty warriors, as blazing as the sun or fire, and as handsome as the moon, those heroes who are endowed with fearful energy and prowess, and who are capable of killing their enemies by a glance of their eyes. Celestials or men or Gandharvas, youthful or handsome, wealthy and adorned with ornaments, my heart is never attracted to any other. I never bathe or eat or sleep till he that is my husband has bathed or eaten or slept, till all our servants and followers have bathed, eaten, and slept. Whenever returning from the field, the forest, or the town, or hastily rising up, I always salute my husband with water and seat. I always keep the house and all the household articles and the food that is to be taken well ordered and clean. I carefully keep the rice and serve them the food at the proper time. I'm never angry. I never speak harsh words. I never imitate women that are wicked. Avoiding idleness, I always do what is agreeable. I never laugh except at a jest. I never stay for a long time at the gate of the house. I never stay in places of nature's call or in pleasure gardens of the house. I always refrain from laughing loudly or indulging in high passion, and from everything that may give offense. O Satyabhama, I am always engaged in serving my husbands. A separation from my husband is never agreeable to me. When my husbands leave home to go to my relatives, I give up flowers and fragrant paste of every kind, and I undergo penances. Whatever my husband does not drink, whatever he does not eat, whatever my husband does not enjoy, I always renounce. O beautiful lady, adorned with ornaments and ever self-controlled by the instructions received by me, I always devotedly seek the welfare of my husbands. I always perform those duties that my mother-in-law formerly told me in respect of relatives. Also, in respect of almsgiving and offering worship to the celestials, of offering oblations to the Pitris, of boiling food on auspicious days in order to offer to the Pitris and the guests, of reference to, of service to those who, that deserve our respect, and of all else that is known to me, I always perform my duty, night and day, without the least idleness, having my heart firmly fixed in humility and fixed in approved rules. I serve my gentle, truthful, and exalted husbands, considering them always first and foremost. And it goes on for many other pages. So, nice instructions from Draupadi. And through that quality that Draupadi had, an attitude of serving her husbands very nicely, her husbands were fully satisfied in their exchanges with her, although one person with five husbands is pretty amazing. So Sukanya also had that very nice quality, and as a result, Chavana Muni started, his mind started to change. He started to think, what can I do to please my wife and satisfy my wife and make my wife more happy? He started to think like that. And as he started to think like that, the Ashwini Kumaras came to visit his hermitage. And the Ashwini Kumaras, their position in the heavenly planets is that they're the physicians of the devatas. Just like Shukracharya is the spiritual master, they're the physician. So, Brihaspati, excuse me. So, They're the royal physicians. So they came to visit Shyamvara Muni, and he requested that basically was, let's make a deal. Shyamvara Muni said, I have a request for you. I would like very much if you could arrange that I could have back my youth and beauty. Because if I could have back my youth and beauty, then my dear wife, Sukanya, would be very happy. Let's just look at this body, old and shriveled and invalid. And if you do, then I will see that you get the Soma Rasa, because apparently, although they were residents in the heavenly planets, there's a pecking order up there, and not everybody has the same opportunity as everybody else, and they were just physicians, they weren't the spiritual masters, so they didn't get that Soma Rasa. The Shyamvara Muni said, I'll see that you get it. Let's make a deal. So they said, very well. We will be glad to help you in this way. So the Ashwini Kumaras, they're not only royal physicians, but they're very, very expert in like mystical medicine, with something like Dhanvantari. The comparison is made. Dhanvantari is an incarnation of the Supreme Lord who provides knowledge of the Vedas in the field of medicine, Ayurveda. So very much like that is compared. The Ashwini Kumaras, they were super physicians. So they knew exactly what to do to fulfill the request. They made an arrangement with Shyamvara Muni. They went to a special lake. They were on, one held one hand and the other held the other hand, and certain potions and certain mantras, and they entered into the lake, and they came out of the lake, all three of them looking like youthful and beautiful, and it worked. So Shyamvara Muni was very happy, and he wanted to inform his good wife, just see what has happened. And when the Ashwini Kumaras and Shyamvara Muni came before Sukanya, she looked the other way, because she was very chaste and she didn't want to have anything to do with anything or anyone other than her husband. So Shyamvara Muni was very disturbed, didn't know what to do. And so after some time passed, the Ashwini Kumaras explained everything to Sukanya, just what had happened, and so she became very happy. And the two of them became very happy together. And as fate would have it, some time later, the father of Sukanya came to visit his daughter and see how his daughter and son-in-law were doing. And when he came, he was shocked. He saw his daughter sitting with this very young, handsome, very attractive young man. And he immediately went to the place and began chastising his daughter. What have you done? What are you doing? You are from a royal family, and we've trained you very nicely. This, your husband, Shyamvara Muni, is very old and invalid. So you've abandoned him for some boy off the street? He said, someone that came out of the village, and who knows what his situation is, and how can you do this? It'll bring ruination to your life. It'll bring ruination to our lives. It'll destroy the whole dynasty. And the statements of the king, Shariati, very much resemble an understanding that comes from the statements of Lord Vishnu when the Kumaras were, they felt insulted by Jayan Vijay, and so Lord Vishnu, being omniscient, knew that that transaction had taken place, that Jayan Vijay had prevented the Kumaras from entering the seventh gate of Vaikuntha, and the Kumaras became very, very unhappy and cursed Jayan Vijay. So Lord Vishnu personally came and said, "We apologize for our mistake." And there's a very nice understanding behind this. He's saying, our acharyas say, it wasn't that the Sanskrit is plural, not dual. Our means not two. In this case, it was plural, multiple. So the actions of the representatives of some personality, in this case Lord Vishnu, or in the other case the king, the representatives of the king, or the representatives of Vishnu, or the representatives of the family, or the representatives of a society of devotees, whatever the case may be, if someone who is associated with that group performs something that's not proper, it not only reflects upon all the other members of that group or that family, or in this case, this is Lord Vishnu saying of the residents of Vaikuntha, then we all bear the consequences of that wrongdoing. And moreover, the Lord Vishnu said, "I personally accept responsibility for the wrong." He didn't immediately jump on the case of Jayan Vijay. Fight. He absorbed the reaction himself, took full responsibility. In fact, the whole of Vaikuntha, taking on behalf of the whole of Vaikuntha that responsibility. So the king Charyati was the same. We should bear that in mind, that as we take up the association of devotees, or when we're members of a particular family, or whatever the group is that we're affiliating ourselves with, we have a great responsibility to act properly, because the consequences are distributed to others. So when the king was all upset like this, he demanded an explanation from his daughter. And she just smiled. And that made him even more disturbed. But then as she offered her explanation, slowly his whole demeanor changed. He was so relieved to understand what had happened, and embraced his daughter and was so thankful, and spent time with Chalanamuni, and returned to his palace. So it was then time for Chabanamuni to make good on his part of the deal. So he arranged for very elaborate soma yagya, and some soma rasa was produced, and he delivered the whole pot of soma rasa to Ashwini Kumaras, and off they went back to heaven, delighted as could be. So it's almost like too good to be true. Everything ends up nice. But there's another little problem. Because when they got to heaven, to the heavenly planets, Indraloka, Indra didn't like it at all. How does this happen? They're not supposed to have this somewhere else. So he came to understand it was Chabanamuni that was responsible. So he took one of his best thunderbolts and had his arm raised, ready to just dash at it and finish off Chabanamuni. And his arm froze. Chabanamuni's mystic powers were so great that Lord Indra was unable to move his arm. And this is part of the narration. My understanding is part of the narration to help us understand just how powerful Chabanamuni was. So someone who is so powerful, you can check the movements of Lord Indra. Just like it's Rath Yatra, we don't want too much rain, so stop raining. Just there, and so it was, something like that. Chabanamuni was so powerful and yet powerful with mystic powers, powerful enough to control the demigods, does not mean that one is in the position of liberation. In fact, he was in the position of captivated by his own lusty desires. So that was the narration concludes with a benediction. Shukadeva Goswami says, the one who hears this narration morning and evening, well, three things are assured. That one will see if I can find it. Yeah. No, it comes later. So, in addition to, so we're still speaking about King Shariati. In addition to his daughter Sukanya, he had three sons, and one of those sons was Uttanabhadi, and another was Satyasena, and another was Anartha. And Anartha ruled the province of Anartha. As far as I know, it's mentioned later in the Bhagavatam, some area in Gujarat. Maybe somebody knows about where that place is. So his son, Anartha's son, was Revata. And Revata did something very much like what Krishna did. He built his palace in the ocean. That's where his residence was. And from there he ruled the province of Anartha and some other place that's mentioned. And he was a very, very pious and great king, and he had one daughter named Revati. And in fact, this daughter Revati was exceptionally qualified personality. And everybody knew it, and certainly the king knew it, Revata. So he... His Revata's son was Kukudmi, and Kukudmi named his daughter after his grandfather, or after his father, so her grandfather. Kukudmi's father was Revata, and his daughter was Revati. So Kukudmi wanted to ensure that his daughter was married to the most suitable and qualified personality. He had several persons in mind, but he wanted some verification and the blessings of Lord Brahma. So he went to visit Lord Brahma. And when he arrived at Brahmaloka, he was unable to get the audience of Lord Brahma right away because Lord Brahma was busy with a concert. There was a Kandarva concert going on. So he just had to wait till the concert was over. And some time passed, a few hours passed, and everyone went their separate ways. After the concert, Lord Brahma called for Kukudmi to come and join him and inquired from him, what is it that I can do? We've come a long distance for some association. What can I do for you? So Kukudmi explained, here's the situation. My daughter Revati is with me, and she's an exceptionally qualified person. And so I want your blessings who she should marry. And Lord Brahma just laughed. And he laughed, and he laughed, and Kukudmi was... What have I done? He was very embarrassed. But then Lord Brahma explained. He said, the time that you've been waiting for this concert to be completed, 27 Divya Yugas have passed on the Earth planet. And your kingdom is completely gone. And those persons that you were thinking that your daughter would marry, they're gone. In fact, when you go back, you won't even recognize the place. But you're right, your daughter is exceptionally qualified. And so I'll make the recommendation who she should marry. And who knows who his daughter was supposed to marry, besides Vishwambar? Anybody know? Does it ring a bell? Revati? Revati is the wife of...
Parashurama?
No. Balaram.
Balaram.
So in the 28th Divya Yuga of the 7th Manu, Vaivasvata Manu, Revati went back to the earth planet and became the wife of Balaram. How do you go? So this is very early in the 9th canto. At the very end of the 9th canto, we hear about the appearance of Krishna and Balaram, because there's a lot of Divya Yugas to catch up with. So that was one of the sons of Maharaj Ambarish. Now one of the sons of Vaivasvata Manu. So another one of the sons of Vaivasvata Manu is the birth of Ambarish Maharaj. So as Shariati was one of Vaivasvata Manu's sons, so also was Nabhaga. And Nabhaga had a number of sons, and the eldest of the number of sons was Nabhaga. So Nabhaga was a very spiritually inclined young boy, so his father sent him to the Gurukula. And at that Satya Yuga, the Gurukula was deep into the forest, and he went as a young boy, and he stayed a long time. In fact, he stayed for such a long time that his younger brothers all grew up, and it was time for them to take some service, and their elder brother hadn't come back yet, so they figured maybe he's just going to remain brahmachari. And so the kingdom was divided up amongst the brothers. And after some time passed, they were ruling for some time, their elder brother came back. Nabhaga came back, and he met with his brothers and said, "What to do?" And they said, "Well, we don't know what to do. The kingdom is all divided. So perhaps you should just consider that your father is your property. Our father is your property." So Nabhaga had a very simple way about him. So he said, "All right, very well. I'll go find my father and let him know what you said." So he went to his father, and his father said, "No way. The father isn't the property of the son. Your brothers have cheated you. But since I'm your father, let me consider very carefully some way that you can maintain yourself." So he made the following suggestion. The suggestion was that not far away, there's a yajna going on. And the yajna is being performed by the descendants of Angira Muni. And it's a long yajna. And I happen to know that on the sixth day of the yajna, there are two hymns that they don't know. And when they get to that stage, they won't be able to complete the yajna. So I'm going to teach you those two hymns. And when they get to that point, you let them know the hymns that they don't know so they can complete the yajna. And then you can ask them for some dakshin and they'll take care of you, don't worry. Just go ahead. Very well. And off he went to the yajna where Angira Muni's descendants were doing their thing. And sure enough, on the sixth day, just as his father had said, it happened. And they were all bewildered, and the king's son, Nabhaga, came forward and said, "I know the two mantras, the two hymns that you require to complete this yajna very well." So he assisted them, and the yogi was completely successful and he made his request, and that the request was that for the yajna, enormous quantities of gold and jewels and ornaments and costly cloth and so many nice things were required for the yajna, and he just asked if I could have those things in charity after the yajna. They're yours. You take them. And the Bhagavatam narrates that the yogi was so successful, they ascended into heaven, leaving behind all this stuff. So now Bhaga proceeded to put everything together, and as he was putting everything together, some person came along down the road and said, "Stop. That belongs to me. What are you doing?" He said, "No, it doesn't belong to you. The sages and the..." And hearing the whole situation, he said, "This man is right. This is Lord Shiva." And the yajna was performed with him as the named deity presiding over the yajna. And so although the brahmanas gave everything to you, it actually belongs to Lord Shiva. So you should give it to Lord Shiva. So Nabhaga said, "Very well. It's all yours." And another thing that's very important comes right now. So Lord Shiva said, "I'm so pleased with both of you, and it's particularly your qualities of honesty and detachment. I give everything to you. And not only that, but I'll teach you transcendental knowledge by which your life will become spiritually perfect." Bhaga said, "Very well. Thank you so much." And this is not an uncommon, in fact it's a refrain within the Bhagavatam, that great personalities are always pleased by the qualities of others, and because of being pleased by those qualities, they shower their blessings and benedictions upon them, not only material, but most importantly, spiritual benedictions. Lord Shiva did the same thing with the Prachetas. If you recall from the Bhagavatam, they were on their way because their father had said, "Produce good children." They said, "Yes, sir." But they were very obedient to their father, just like Ram hearing from Dasarath, "Go to the forest, and you're not the king." "Yes, sir, whatever you say." Being very submissive to the instruction of their father, their superior. And so the Prachetas were intercepted by Lord Shiva, who gave them some mantra, or stotra, by which they could pray while they were underwater for 10,000 years, undergoing purification. So they could become not just purified, but in meditation and austerities, but become transcendentally realized, which is what happened. So that's what happened with Nabhaga also. He, if you recall, he had no kingdom. But he had enormous wealth, and he was a perfectly realized soul, which is the greatest of all wealth. And his son was Maharaj Ambarish. And so Maharaj Ambarish, the system is the son would inherit the property of the father, but his father had no kingdom, but he had all this wealth. But Maharaj Ambarish inherited not only the wealth of his father, but the qualities of his father. And therefore, in course of time, as he matured into a young man, he became appreciated by everyone, literally everyone. And so he was requested to take the position of the emperor of the world, from nothing to the emperor of the world. And so along with the emperor and the ruling the whole world, he had this enormous wealth. But more importantly, most importantly, is he had a pure, the quality of pure devotion. So when Shukadeva Goswami is describing this history. He speaks about Maharaj Parikshit, Maharaj Ambarish, and he describes him as a Mahabhagavata. Does everybody know what that means? Mahabhagavata? Mahabhagavata. It's the highest stage of possible spiritual attainment for an embodied soul. That terminology is used within the Bhagavatam like that. Topmost spiritual attainment, Mahabhagavata. And along with that terminology is also used priti, and Prabhupada translated as that he had special qualifications. So just hearing that information, then there was one other thing that was mentioned about Maharaj Ambarish, and that is due to his spiritual qualification, he was able to counteract the infallible curse of a brahmana. So Maharaj Pariksha interrupts the narration, says, stop right there. I want to hear something more about this person. Something like Shukadeva Goswami, something like Lord Shiva being so pleased with Nabhaga, he wanted to give his benediction. In this case, Maharaj Pariksha wanted to hear the glories of a Mahabhagavata whose qualities were so astounding and his spiritual qualification was so astounding that the infallible curse of a brahmana could be checked. And so that leads to two more chapters of just describing, actually three chapters of describing Maharaj Ambarish. So the spotlight is now on Maharaj Ambarish with his appreciating his qualification. Now naturally, Maharaj Pariksit has special interest in this qualification that Maharaj Ambarish had, being able to counteract the curse of a brahmana, because that was his situation. He was under the curse of a brahmana. And Maharaj Ambarish was able to counteract it without even doing anything. So it's an interesting topic for him to hear about. And one other this note is in this process of the whole of the Bhagavatam is in the format of questions and answers. So someone is speaking something and a listener takes particular interest in one item along the way, and can you explain something more about this? Or it says over here about this and over there about that, and could you expand on that understanding? And so this questioning and answering method, which is the Srimad Bhagavatam, the construct of it, takes further and further and further and further meanings. And then from that, then another one, and that another one, and that another one, and then it comes back to the main storyline, and then another question, and another branch comes out. And so the questioning and answering method is very, very effective, not just for getting more detailed information about something, but in the case of Maharaj Pariksit, he wants to hear the glories of a pure devotee. He wants to hear the qualities of that pure devotee. He wants to appreciate the devotional service rendered by them. He's a nectar hound. And so he's probing with his questions to get Shukadeva Goswami to discuss more. And he did because, so in the next verse, kriti is used in the previous verse, and the language that's used by Maharaj Pariksit when he asks his question is dhimataha. So Prabhupada has translated that as most exalted and meritorious in character. He was so exalted and so meritorious that Brahmadanda, the curse of a brahmana, was ineffective. Just bounced off him. Please describe this person more. So Shukadeva Goswami does that. He describes, so just take another 15 or 20 minutes to describe a little bit about his qualities, so and his position. Shukadeva Goswami describes that he ruled the seven planets, the seven islands. He ruled the planet, the seven continents. And he had shriyam, opulences that were avyayam, just unlimited opulence. But he was completely detached. The verse says, or Shukadeva Goswami said, that Maharaj Ambarish knew what normally happens with opulences. For an ordinary person, when they receive opulences, then their consciousness becomes contaminated. They become attached to those opulences and try to become enjoyers of those opulences and become degraded by opulences. And his opulences were opulences, Shukadeva Goswami says, that you can't even dream of in a dream. But he was completely detached. He saw them as no more significant than a stone in the street. Just like if we walk out the door, and of course not many stones around here, it's grass and pavement, but maybe there's a stone out there somewhere. You pass by a stone and get all excited, right? There's a stone. Is that significant? Just walk right by. So he was extremely opulent, he was extremely religious, extremely devoted, and extremely detached. Then in the next verse, some little appreciation about the composition of the Bhagavatam. The verse begins with Vasudeva Bhagavati. And I've noticed this in my reading of the Bhagavatam, how Vyasadeva has composed the Bhagavatam, that there are certain phrases that appear like refrains. And when you hear that phrase, it brings to your mind, if you're familiar with the Bhagavatam, it brings to your mind a whole bunch of different things just to hear that phrase. So that this phrase, Vasudeva Bhagavati, it appears in the very beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the first canto, chapter 2. Who knows the verse? Let me just see a show of hands who knows the verse. Prithu, Shrava, what's the verse?
Vasudeva Bhagavati, Bhakti Yoga Prayojita, Janya Pyashri Vairagya, Janam Sharanagya.
Can you explain?
So bhakti yoga performed unto the Supreme Lord.
I hope, Sanjay.
Janyatyashu Vairagyam Jnanam Chaya very, very quickly brings two side effects. Along with it, accompanied very quickly, brings both vairagya, detachment, and knowledge.
Yeah. So devotional service rendered unto the Supreme Lord. This is when you think of Maharaj Ambarish in the future, you should think of this Vasudeva Bhagavad. He was fixed in pure devotion. In I'm studying Brihat Bhagavatamrita, and Sanatana Goswami says there are interesting things. He says there's 4.5 categories of bhakti. The half a category is where devotion is mixed. Devotional service is performed for the Supreme Lord, but there is some interest for some material thing. And the example he gives is Dhruva. He served, but he wanted a kingdom. And so that's the half. But then the first category is Shuddha Bhakti. Real Bhakti is Shuddha Bhakti. And Maharaj Ambarish is given as the example. He's rendering devotional service in this world. And so Adhoksaja is appropriate because Adhoksaja means one who's beyond the senses. But we use our senses to serve one who's beyond the senses. It means you have to have faith in a higher principle beyond what you can perceive with the senses. But one who does have faith and serves the Supreme who is beyond the senses with the senses, you get realization of the Supreme who is beyond the senses through the heart. And when one is filled with that reciprocation with the Lord through the heart, detachment is automatically there. Detachment from the senses and the worldly things the senses come in contact with. Detachment is automatically there. Not only detachment is automatically there, all kinds of exalted qualities are there. In this world, knowledge is always very much revered. How many, I hear from parents grumblings these days of how much it costs to send a kid to college. I mean, when you add up the cost of a child's education from whenever they begin to whenever they're done, huge expenditure, but because it's very much valued in the world. And that's even just material knowledge. What to speak of the value of transcendental knowledge. It's so much revered. But one who takes up this rendering of devotional service like Maharaj Ambarish did with his senses in the service of one who's beyond the senses, knowledge is just a speck. And he had, as far as what he had everything. Opulences that you can't even dream of, and he was completely detached from it. Vasudeva Bhagavati. Tad bhakteshu cha sadhushu prapto bhavam param vishvam yenidam lostravat smrita. Lostravat. He just saw it like a piece of stone. Lostravat. Yeah. Because he was attached to the Supreme Vasudeva. He was ruling the world. Immediately following that verse is where I'm going to end for this morning, or is that whatever we are, the afternoon. What follows is the the most famous verse out of this whole section that Prabhupada would quote over and over again. Savaimana Krishna Padara Vindayor. Vachangsi Vaikuntha Gunana Varnane. So, Savaimana Krishna Padara. I remember hearing Prabhupada quoting that verse over and over again and never having heard about Maharaj Ambarish. But what stands out in my mind, how Prabhupada would describe it, was that before he did anything else, he fixed his mind upon the Supreme Lord. And he did so with various regulative activities. But even before he did so with those regulative activities, he fixed his mind upon the Supreme. Just like, you know, we have our process of chanting on our beads to fix our mind on Krishna. So he did similar things. There's a whole list of things that Maharaj Ambarish did. Three verses in a row of describing the details of what he did. But the way that Prabhupada described it is, first he fixed his mind upon the Supreme Lord. And to assist him in fixing his mind upon the Supreme Lord, he did these other things. Vachansi Vaikuntha Gunana Varnane. With his words he glorified the Supreme Personality of Godhead. With his hands he cleansed the temple of the Lord. In fact, in our Guru Vastakam prayers, we have this Mandir Marjanado. So it comes same Sanskrit right in the verse. Karau Harer Mandira Marjanadishu. In other words, the same things that we do, he did. And he became perfect. So he's a good role model for us to study very carefully and understand if we want to become more advanced in our spiritual lives. We should pay great attention to this narration of the devotional service rendered by Maharaj Ambarish, because we're following the same practices. We're not unlimitedly opulent. We're not perfectly detached, and we don't have the kind of parentage that he had and so forth and so on. But he followed a process. So Savai Manat Krishna Padara Vindayo. If I had to, I had more time than I'm going to have here in Chicago with this topic when I was in Tuaco, and I was thinking maybe I should give an exam at the end of the seminar. And if I did, this is one thing I would require, is memorize these first two lines, very simple. Because when you think of Maharaj Ambarish, you should think, Savai Mana Krishna Padara Vindayo Vaikuntha Vachamsi Vaikuntha Gunana Vardhane Savai Mana Krishna Padara Vindayo Padara Vindayo. Fix the mind upon the personality, because we'll see as the story unfolds, like Prahlad, when Prahlad was put at risk by Hiranyakashipu, Prahlad's mind didn't change at all, because his mind is fixed. Savai Manat Krishna Padara Vindaya. So Ambarish Maharaj wasn't just a good devotee. He had nice practices. He was fixed in pure devotion. So I think that's where I should end. No. I want to go a little bit further. Is anybody falling asleep? Are we okay?
Yeah, well,
huh?
Yeah, there's a
view. Okay.
How are you hearing in the back, actually?
You can hear okay? Yeah. In the translation, well, I'll say a couple of things. In the translation of the verse, at the very end, it's three verses, three long Sanskrit verses, and at the very end, Prabhupada writes in the translation, this is the way of increase attachment for the Lord, and be completely free from all material desires. The two are, it's a couplet. Attachment to Krishna means detachment from what is apart from Krishna's interest, material desires. It's not material. Maharaj Ambarish, although he was completely unattached, he nonetheless was completely surrounded by opulence. In other words, his detachment wasn't manifest in just throwing it all away. He was extremely charitable. He regularly will hear about his charity. I want you to turn the speaker so the reverb, just aim it out instead of the echo. Hopefully it'll do something. So he engaged every one of his senses. When in Nectar of Devotion, there's a chapter where Maharaj, this very verse, that we're covering right now is discussed in Nectar Devotion. It gives a full translation of the verse, and it comes right after Prabhupada gives a description of the nine processes of bhakti and those who achieve perfection by each one of the nine processes of bhakti. We can go through that, but time will not permit to do everything we want to do. So after discussing the nine processes of bhakti, Prabhupada introduces Maharaj Ambarish and says that he achieved perfection through all of the nine processes of bhakti. But then it's not, the verse is not actually how he did all the nine processes of bhakti. But he engaged all of his senses, engaged his hands in cleansing the temple, his eyes in seeing the deity form, decorating the deity of the Lord, offering various prayers to the Lord, associating and serving the devotees of the Lord. And he did these, Prabhupada once described, lecture I heard, he did this till 10:30, 11 every morning. Now, imagine before some of you that went to work had that kind of sadhana program. You know, rise really early until 10:30, 11 in the morning. We still wouldn't match Maharaj Ambarish. But he was the emperor of the world. And that's what he did. Which means that he ruled by spiritual strength. He didn't rule by running around all over the place and getting the job done. He ruled by spiritual strength. And we'll hear some more about that also. Now, in the purport, it's a short purport to this very important verse. And the focus that Prabhupada puts in the purport is, I'll just read it. In Bhagavad Gita 7:1, the Lord recommends maya sakta manak partha yogam yunjan marashraya. This indicates that one must execute devotional service under the guidance of a devotee, or directly under the guidance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because that verse, Krishna is saying, I will now describe to you how you can fix your mind upon the Supreme Lord. Because it comes from the previous verse, the last verse in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, it is my opinion that the topmost yogi is one who engages always with faith in rendering devotional service unto me. And now I'm going to describe to you how that can be done. So Prabhupada is highlighting, we need the guidance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead or the Lord's pure devotee. And then next he says, it is not possible, however, to train oneself without guidance from the spiritual master. Therefore, according to the instructions of Srila Rupa Goswami, the first business of a devotee is to accept a bona fide spiritual master who can train him to engage his various senses, which is what Maharaj Ambarish did, in rendering devotional service to the Lord. It's a different chapter. It's in chapter 6, where it's that the principles... No, further chapter. Principles of devotional service. There's a section in Nectar Devotion where a list of 64 items of what's how to render devotional service is identified. And in that list, Rupa Goswami identifies there are three that are most important. Out of that same list, he says there are five that are so powerful that if one renders them with faith, then one can experience bhava. But aside from that, highlighting those five things, he indicates there's three that are most important. Even before listing the 64 items, Rupa Goswami says that I will only describe a principle here. I'm not going to go into details. He gives the example of, it's a principle that one must take shelter under spiritual master and receive instructions from the spiritual master. And it's a detail what instructions are given. So, just like Lord Chaitanya, he engaged different devotees in different ways according to what was suited for them. But he guided them, he instructed them, they performed their devotional service accordingly and achieved perfection. One was told, this is one particular setting in Chaitanya Charitamrita, one was told, you stay here in Puri and you worship the deity. Another, you go back and earn money and maintain the Vaishnavas. You stay here and just serve the devotees in Puri. Different instructions, but it's the principle is what's highlighted by Rupa Goswami. So the three things out of this long list of 64 items are, and it's what Prabhupada is quoting in this purport, the three items are taking shelter under a bona fide spiritual master and receiving initiation. Another is taking the training from that spiritual master how to render devotional service. And another is following the path of the previous acharyas under the direction of the spiritual master. So these three items are essential out of all the items. And so Prabhupada is highlighting it with Maharaj Ambarish, he's our role model, achieving perfection through the process of worship, through the same, very same process that we follow. And that's where Prabhupada is drawing our attention, our listener. We require that, not just training ourselves in that process, but submitting ourselves to being trained according to that process. That's Krishna's system. So just a few other verses and we're ended. When Maharaj Ambarish performed his duties, he performed everything that he did impeccably carefully, but with complete detachment. So, in other words, he was a pure devotee, but if one wanted to analyze, was he successful in the process of karma yoga? He was successful in the process of karma yoga. He performed his duties without any attachment. Although he was detached from the opulences, he performed his duties without attachment. And as a king, he respected Brahminical culture. And Shukadeva Goswami says, as a result, his kingdom was perfectly organized and all the citizens were perfectly happy. And that's another very important Bhagavatam principle, is respect of Brahminical culture. Because without there's five things, but particularly the respecting of the brahmanas, care of elderly, protection of women, protection of cows.
Children.
Old people. Elderly, I said. And care for children. Without those five things, without all those five things, society will not prosper, will be in chaos. But of those five things, Brahminical culture is always in a very high position because where Brahminical culture is there, and cow protection, those two actually, then the other things will naturally follow. And if cow protection is ignored, will elderly be respected and children be cared for properly? So, Brahminical culture, he was a pure devotee, he was in intimate contact with the Supreme Lord, still in principle, as example, he surrounded himself with pure devotee brahmanas, He heard, he took their counsel, and he ministrated according to their counsel. Therefore, everything was peaceful and prosperous and went very, very nicely. Very important principle. Very practical and very important principle. I'd just like to read how Prabhupada comments at the end of that purport. Citizens under the guidance of a Krishna conscious king will become devotees. And then there will be no need to enact new laws every day to reform the way of life of the state. Then he adds this brahminical principle. If the citizens are trained to become devotees, they will automatically become peaceful and honest. And if they are guided by a devotee king advised by devotee brahmanas, the state will not only be in material, the state will not be in the material world, but in the spiritual world. All the states of the world should therefore follow the ideal rule or administration of Maharaj Ambarish as described here. This is a theme of Prabhupada's preaching overall. He wanted to see that the heads of state were devotees, not that devotees become competitors to become the head of state, but the head of state would be devotees. And those devotees who are very qualified devotees, heads of state, would receive brahminical counsel. And everything will be like Vaikuntha. Then there's one, I'll end with this. Sukadeva Goswami describes the, there was one province in the kingdom where it was practically a desert. It sounds something like, the way that it's described, it sounds a little bit like Rajasthan, where the Saraswati River flows, and the place was arid, and there was no vegetation. So although he's a pure devotee, Prabhupada comments on this, although he's a pure devotee, he's just engaged in Krishna bhakti. He engaged some sages, Devala, Asita, and Gotama, to perform a special kind of yagya that would produce rain. And he provided lavishly everything that they needed for the yagya, and it produced rain, and rainfall came even in that arid place. So it's interesting for me that it's particularly that there was no question from his side, he was a Vaishnava. But he employed persons that weren't necessarily taking up a Vaishnava yagya, but something that would produce the rain in that particular place, and that's what he had them do. He employed them in that way, and the rainfall came, and he was doing his duties for the citizens. Although he himself didn't take up that activity, he didn't deviate from the Savai Mana Krishna Padara Vindayo and his worship of... Actually, he was a Krishna Bhakta. We're going to hear about that in a little bit. So he did his duties absolutely perfectly. All the citizens were materially and spiritually perfectly satisfied, and he was detached from the whole thing, but doing everything impeccably. And his attention did not deviate for even a moment from the personality of Godhead. So these are some of his qualities, and we're going to see how a person who has qualities may sometimes get a test of circumstance of life. So that's about to happen in this narration. Okay, so I'll end there. See if there's some points you'd like to discuss. Yeah.
Narrating how Sukanya was able to counteract the bad qualities or smooth out the rough edges of her
grumpy husband, right?
With her own gentle nature, good qualities. So one could argue, well, people do argue, that in today's world, where men aren't able to, say, maintain a household with their single income, and women are necessarily finding themselves in, like, the work world, you know, that women are also finding themselves dealing with the dog-eat-dog world and, you know, the modes of nature and all that bad association that men have to deal with. So one could argue that women themselves now, unfortunately, also require somebody to smooth out their rough edges. And, you know, because of this situation of Sukanya, she's obviously home cultivating the gentle nature.
Yeah, she wasn't going up to the office.
How are we to see, it seems unfair or impractical or unrealistic for women in those shoes today to follow that example. And I'm just wondering how we would address this for modern day women, especially brought up in the Western culture, the lack of culture.
Well, this is a big topic and a delicate topic, but when we just a rule of thumb, whenever we deviate from Vedic principle, we're putting ourselves in a compromised position that has an endless series of adjustments that have no ultimate resolution to them. That's something I believe in strongly. And the problem, one could say, it's the way, you know, the economic structure of society is. The way the economic structure of society is. Taxes are such, and costs of commodities are such, and so on and so on and so on are such that it's just not really so feasible for, and so that's one of the mindsets that brings about the two persons working situation. Or husband and wife decide in careful contemplation that due to circumstances, due to a certain nature, due to the environment that we're in, anyway, we'll go ahead with that plan. We'll both work, but then, you know, there's a compromise with the Vedic principle, and it leads to complication. So, but one can do the series of adjustments as best one can, have a less aggressive environment as far as possible, or this or that or the other adjustment. But it leads to its complications, that's for sure. So your question was, you took it in a direction I didn't expect you to take it. You were saying, you know, one might make the argument that women also need, those who are in that situation need something to smooth out their edges, and where is that going to come from?
So what I'm saying, so therefore, one will argue that it's unfair for men to feel that women should take that role that Sukanya gives, because they themselves are victims of having.
That's right.
And they're more victims because they're actually built less capable of dealing with it.
That's right. That's right. I've not heard that argument, but I think it's a reasonable. Is part of the consequences of compromise. We can't expect the Sukanya model. We can't expect the Draupadi model.
And
men will have to understand that and adjust to that. And but what the statement that Prabhupada is making in the purport is it's not only men need to understand that, but at least the statements that Prabhupada made, I can read them again for our audition if you want me to, but the situation will be less than peaceful. Even he understands, she understands, and they agree, it's going to be less than peaceful. It's going to be, you know, less than Vedic peaceful. Less than Vaikuntha. Guaranteed. I mean, just for starters. And then downhill from there, but it's an unrealistic expectation. Now, one can go the other way and say, however that's true, we want to, we, not just I, the husband, but we, husband and wife, want to recognize our nature and the world that we're in and so on and so forth. And so we will adjust accordingly, but we don't want to adjust it so it's unrecognizable. In some ways, for example, that the husband will sometimes take care of the kitchen duties and the cleaning duties because the wife and the picking up of the kids and the doing of this and the that, and we'll share those chores and responsibilities and we'll help one another in that kind of a mood, for example. Whereas that's not the Sukanya model or the Draupadi model. So that's our understanding how to